From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Bernie Kerry blames the nanny, but was it really an undocumented worker in his home that scuttled his nomination for Homeland Security Secretary? No way. A whole lot more complicated than that. Personal scandals, political scandals, business scandals. This guy never would have gotten through a decent background check.
Bernard Kerik has withdrawn his name for Homeland Security Chief. We'll speak with Newsday columnist Ellis Hennigan, then go to Canada to speak with U.S. Army war resister Jeremy Hinsman, who's just finished a hearing appealing for refugee status. And we'll look at the injuries that soldiers are suffering in Iraq and the increasing number of homeless veterans here in the United States. Also, investigative reporter Gary Webb died this weekend of an apparent suicide.
America owes Gary Webb a great debt. He was the reporter who brought forth an awful lot of history about how the Reagan and Bush administration permitted the Contras to ship cocaine into the United States.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, up to 13 people have died and over a dozen more have been wounded after a powerful suicide bomb exploded at a checkpoint outside the Green Zone earlier today. The bombing comes on the first anniversary of the capture of Saddam Hussein. Meanwhile, fighting has resumed in and around Fallujah. On Sunday, U.S. forces dropped 10 precision-guided bombs in parts of the city, and seven Marines died in the region, making it the deadliest day for U.S. troops since October. Nearly 1,300 U.S. troops have now died in Iraq. The U.S. also bombed parts of Mosul over the weekend. In the city of Hit, Iraqi fighters ambushed members of the Iraqi National Guard, killing seven. In separate attacks in Baghdad and Kirkuk, three high-ranking Iraqi police forces were killed. Meanwhile, it's been reported several of Saddam Hussein's top aides have gone on a hunger strike to protest their jail conditions. And Hussein may have also gone on a hunger strike, though the U.S. is denying this. A year after his capture, Saddam Hussein has appeared only once in a public hearing during a brief court proceeding. He is being kept in a secret location, still has not met with any of his attorneys. Iraqi officials say they don't expect his trial to begin until early 2006. Iraq's interim president, Ghazi Hawar, has accused the Bush administration of making a huge mistake by dismantling the Iraqi army after toppling Saddam Hussein. In an interview with the BBC, Yawar said the move has led to the deteriorating security situation in Iraq. In a separate interview with the London-based Asharqa Ahsat magazine newspaper, Yawar warned that the growing instability and lack of security in Iraq could give birth to a, quote, Iraqi Hitler. Yawar said, quote, this could be in the long term create an environment in which an Iraqi Hitler could emerge like the one created by the defeat of Germany and the humiliation of Germans in World War I. Meanwhile, U.S. Staff Sergeant Johnny Horn has been sentenced to 3 years in jail for the killing of an unarmed, injured 16-year-old Iraqi. Horn pled guilty to unpremeditated murder. In other news from Iraq, USA Today has determined that part-time soldiers in the Army National Guard are about one-third more likely to be killed in Iraq than full-time active-duty soldiers, in part because of lack of training and lack of proper equipment. Jailed Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti has withdrawn from the race to be president of the Palestinian Authority. Barghouti had been the most popular contender challenging Mahmoud Abbas. There was intense pressure on Barghouti to drop out from both within his Fatah party and the international community. Secretary of State General Colin Powell called his nomination problematic, while European donors had quietly threatened to slash aid to the Palestinian Authority – if he were to win. Meanwhile, in Rafah, five Israeli soldiers died Sunday when a booby-trapped tunnel blew up under their army post along the Egyptian border. Six soldiers were wounded in the blast. Hamas and a faction of Fatah known as Fatah Hawks claimed joint responsibility for the attacks. The White House is in search of a new Homeland Security director following Friday's surprise announcement from former New York Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik that he has withdrawn his name from consideration. Kerik officially claimed he was not seeking the post after he learned he had employed an undocumented worker as a nanny and that he had not paid income taxes. But there has been wide speculation that the nanny issue is just the tip of the iceberg. Hours before his announcement, Newsweek had uncovered that an arrest warrant was issued for Kerik in 1988 over a dispute involving unpaid bills. The Daily News has since reported Kerik had illegally accepted thousands of dollars in cash and gifts while a public official. The Wall Street Journal raised questions about his connection to the stun gun manufacturer Taser and how he made millions in a recent stock sale. Questions were also raised about his failure in Iraq to train new Iraqi police, as well as his misuse of police power while the head of the New York Police Department. Despite Kerik's past, his announcement Friday still came as a surprise, in part because no top Democrat opposed his nomination. New York Senators Hillary Clinton and Charles Schumer had both repeatedly praised his qualifications. Bernard Kerik reportedly will now return to working for Rudolph Giuliani's firm, Giuliani Partners. Democratic Senator Joseph Lieberman has been mentioned as one possible candidate to take the security post. The Bush administration has begun spying on the head of the UN International Atomic Energy Agency in an attempt to uncover information that could lead to his ouster. This according to the Washington Post. The U.S. reportedly has tapped Mohammed al-Baradei's phones and intercepted dozens of calls. The Bush administration has been at odds with al-Baradei since he rightly stated that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This is the third report over the past 2 years of the Bush administration or its allies spying on officials at the United Nations. In March 2003, the Observer newspaper revealed the National Security Agency had ordered increased eavesdropping on UN diplomats ahead of the Security Council vote on Iraq. Earlier this year, former British cabinet minister Clare Short revealed British spies had eavesdropped on UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. In Britain, new questions have emerged over whether foul play was involved in the death of a top government scientist last year. The scientist, David Kelly, was found dead shortly after it was revealed he was the source of a BBC report that questioned the veracity of the government's report on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Officials at the time said that David Kelly had committed suicide by slashing his wrists. But now the two paramedics who treated Kelly at the scene have come forward to tell the Observer newspaper that Kelly could not have died from the wound they saw on his wrist. Doctors in Vienna have confirmed that Ukrainian opposition leader and presidential hopeful Viktor Yushchenko was poisoned several months ago. Doctors said he has 1,000 times the normal amount of dioxin in his body. The poisoning has disfigured his face over the past few months. The candidate fell sick September 6th, a day after meeting with the head of the Security Service of Ukraine, as well as others. 2 weeks after the meeting, Yushchenko first suggested there had been an attempt on his life. In other Ukraine news, the Associated Press is reporting the Bush administration spent more than $65 million over the past 2 years in the lead-up to last month's election in the Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has charged Washington with interfering with Ukraine's internal affairs. Some of the money was spent to bring opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko to Washington to meet U.S. leaders, as well as to underwrite the exit polls that indicated he won the disputed election. No money was spent directly on Yushchenko's political party, but officials acknowledge money was sent to help train groups and individuals opposed to the Russian-backed government candidate. The Department of Homeland Security has been experimenting with a massive privately run computer database that allows investigators to match financial transactions against a financial watch list of some 250,000 people and firms. The New York Times reports the watch lists reportedly contain people with suspected ties to terrorist financing, drug trafficking, money laundering, and other financial crimes. The program is being developed by a British company called WorldCheck that gathers data from 140,000 public sources. Mark Rottenberg, executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, said the government likely outsourced the project to a private firm in order to circumvent U.S. privacy laws. Rottenberg said, quote, "There's a real risk in a situation like this because there's really no accountability. People can find themselves on a watch list incorrectly, and the consequences can be very serious," he said. In Afghanistan, 18,000 U.S. forces are taking part in a major new offensive dubbed Lightning Freedom to hunt down members of the Taliban. Meanwhile, the Pakistani government is denying a report in today's New York Times that the U.S. set up a series of secret CIA posts in Pakistan to help in the hunt for Osama bin Laden. President Bush has nominated Samuel Bodman to serve as the country's next Secretary of Energy. He's been working for the Bush administration since 2001, first as Deputy Commerce Secretary, then Deputy Treasury Secretary. The Sierra Club criticized his hands-off position on global warming when he oversaw the work of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency as Deputy Secretary of Commerce. The Sierra Club Executive Director, Carl Pope, said, quote, "He was literally in charge of watching the polar ice caps melt." Prior to coming to Washington, Bodman headed the chemical company Cabot. The Knight Ridder News Agency reports that during Bodman's tenure at Cabot, the government twice fined the company for failing to report hazardous spills and not complying with federal cleanup orders. And in Alaska, a Malaysian freighter carrying soybeans has split in two and leaked out thousands of gallons of heavy fuel. Six crew members are believed to have died in the accident. The ship was carrying about 500,000 gallons of fuel. Officials fear it could be Alaska's biggest oil spill since the Exxon Valdez ran aground in 1989. Bad weather has so far hampered cleanup efforts. The accident occurred near the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, a nesting haven for 40 million seabirds and numerous marine mammals. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House is in search of a new Homeland Security director following Friday's surprise announcement from former New York Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik that he's withdrawing his name. Kerik officially claimed he's not seeking the post after he learned that he'd employed an undocumented worker as a nanny and that he hadn't paid income taxes on her. But an array of other charges and questions about Kerik's controversial past have dominated news headlines over the weekend. Newsweek uncovered that an arrest warrant was issued for Kerik as recently as 6 years ago over a dispute over unpaid bills. The 1998 warrant was issued as part of a convoluted series of lawsuits related to unpaid bills on his condominium in New Jersey. The New York Daily News reports Kerik had illegally accepted thousands of dollars in cash and gifts from a public official. A Daily News probe revealed that for many years, one of Kerik's main benefactors was Lawrence Ray. Ray was later indicted on unrelated federal charges tied to what the Daily News called a, quote, $40 million mob-run pump-and-dump stock swindle. The Washington Post reports 9 employees of the hospital Carrick worked at, providing security in Saudi Arabia, accused him of using his policing powers to pursue the personal agenda of his immediate boss. Questions have also been raised about Carrick's misuse of police power while the head of the New York Police Department. In one example, he was fined for using the services of 3 police officers to help research his autobiography, The Lost Son. He was also accused of sending homicide squad police to question Fox News journalists after the book's publisher, Judith Regan, lost a mobile phone after an interview at Fox Studios. It turned out to have just been misplaced. On Thursday, the day before he withdrew his name from contention, Carrick was forced to testify in a civil lawsuit about an alleged affair with a subordinate. Carrick has also come under increasing scrutiny for his windfall profit from stock options in the stun gun manufacturer Taser International. He netted over $5.5 million on the options without ever having invested any of his own money. Questions have also been raised about his failure in Iraq to train a new Iraqi police force. Carrick went to Iraq for a 6-month tour of duty to help rebuild the Iraqi police force, but he abruptly left after just 3 months. Former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, a close friend of Carrick, who reportedly pressed hard for his nomination, also his employer, apologized to President Bush Sunday for the problems with Carrick's nomination. President Bush had dinner with Rudolph Giuliani. Ellis Hennekin is on the line with us now, a columnist for Newsday in New York. His recent piece on Bernard Carrick is called, I Hate to Say I Told You So, But I Told You So. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ellis.
Good morning, Amy. That's an exhausting list of scandals and bad judgments and questionable scenarios, isn't it?
Well, you were asking the questions when we had you on last week at a time when there were no Democrats in Washington, no Democratic senators certainly saying that they were going to oppose this nomination. Is it because all of this just came out over the weekend?
No. This stuff has floated around for a long time. I tell you what I think it was primarily, especially among the New Yorkers and the other East Coast people. They looked at Bernie Carrick, and I'm talking here about Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and others you might think would ask tough questions of a Bush nominee. I think they were so excited about the idea that New York and some of the other big cities were going to get more money from Homeland Security. They thought he would be a more receptive secretary than Tom Ridge had been. They didn't want to ask any questions at all.
Why not?
Well, because I think they wanted to have him in there. And if he were in there, they thought they would do better in the budget battles than they had been doing. I mean, you've seen these comparisons, right, where states like Wyoming and Montana and Alaska are getting 4 and 5 times per capita the amount of Homeland Security money that New York and Washington and Los Angeles and San Francisco and big cities where you have to guess would have to be at somewhat greater risk than the prairies of the middle part of the country.
Now, Bernard Carrick has been in public life for quite a while. I mean, he went to train the Iraqi police force, and then with these series of bombings of the UN, the Jordanian embassy, and other places, he suddenly was gone, of course, as police commissioner and before. And yet, this hasn't come out, although there have been smaller investigations asking questions.
You know what happened? The media coverage is, I think, quite fascinating, and I would exclude you and a couple of others from this. But in the first few days after his name was announced as the president's choice, pretty much what we got in the media were stories about a 9/11 hero who had stood beside Rudy as the towers tumbled. And recollections of his own rise from a tough childhood. Now, I love that story. I mean, I love the story of the hooker's son who comes and rises into law enforcement. I mean, it's a nice story. But nobody, or very few people, were writing the tough stories that were out there so easily to be written. 10 days ago, I did a column in Newsday that said Bernie Kerik is a ticking time bomb that the Bushies will learn to regret. And I said, don't say I didn't warn you guys. And the piece that you cited yesterday was my, allowing myself, a small amount of gloating, which might be bad manners, but I think is justified in this case. Very few of us were out there early. By this weekend, there was a huge pile on, and there were stories everywhere, all kind of people saying, oh, we knew this would never fly.
There was a report in the New York Times. There was an editor's note at the top. The story was reported Friday evening before Bernard Kerik, for personal reasons, withdrew his name as the nominee.
Uh-huh.
But it's about a business partner of Bernard Kerik and Rudolph Giuliani's, saying that Kerik's role as an advisor to the Department of Homeland Security gave them insight into where the government was investing its resources, which was helpful in choosing potential business ventures. This was Newsday. Mm-hmm. Newsday also learned Friday that Kerik, who withdrew his nomination, has resigned from the board of a second company, Camelback Products,
right,
which has sold at least $16 million worth of equipment to the government, including a border patrol squads overseen by the Department of Homeland Security, that kind of container of water with a straw that you
can
drink
from. Right, a knapsack that carries water, basically, Camelback. Listen, Amy, it's all indicative of the business that he has been in with Rudy Giuliani in the last couple of years. They sell their knowledge and expertise of the way government operates, and they're selling essentially a self-confidence at dealing with the big bad world out there. It's turned out to be a very successful and lucrative business, but it creates these relationships that get a little dicey if you then want to go back into public service.
We're talking to Ellis Hennekin, who writes for Newsday, a columnist for Newsday, and we're going to come back with him in just a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, when it rains, it pours. Now there isn't a day that the paper's not filled with exposés on Bernard Kerik. The latest in the Daily News today, that as police commissioner, Bernard Kerik had conducted two affairs simultaneously using a secret Battery Park City apartment for his liaisons. Ellis Hennekin on the line with us, Newsday columnist. Last night, Mayor Giuliani had a meal with President Bush. What does this mean for Mayor Giuliani having revealed, at least twice intervened personally to get Bernard Kerik nominated to be security chief or head of Department of Homeland Security?
Boy, what an interesting question. It's obviously not good. If it were not for Rudy, Bernie would not have been in the mix at all. No one would have even thought about him. Every job, the big job that Kerik got in the last, 10 years of his life was really the work in large measure of Rudy Giuliani. The Bushies feel burned. I mean, the people that we're talking to are expressing irritation and frustration and disappointment about it. It's probably an overstatement, though, to say that it wrecks Giuliani's relationship with the White House or something like that. Remember, he was a terrifically valuable campaigner to the president. He was worked very hard for Bush's reelection. He remains a popular figure out across America, probably more popular, I think, than he is in New York these days. And, you know, that's very valuable to the Bush administration. So somehow or another, they will find a way, even if there's a certain lack of trust or a certain skepticism there, they'll find a way to work together, I'm sure.
Ellis Hennigan, I want to thank you very much for being with us, columnist with New York Newsday. Well, Newsday in general. Thank you. And we're going to turn now to latest stories out of Iraq and the attempts by one U.S. Army conscientious objector to get refugee status in Canada. A suicide bomber killed at least seven Iraqis at an entrance to the heavily fortified Green Zone in Baghdad Monday. The U.S. military said no U.S. soldiers were hurt in the bombing that comes a day after seven U.S. Marines were killed in two separate incidents west of Baghdad. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about the level of injuries that U.S. soldiers are sustaining, as well as the number of veterans who are coming home and now becoming homeless. But right now, we turn to U.S. Army war resister Jeremy Hinsman, who made his case last Monday for Canada to give him refugee status. Hinsman fled to Canada in January after his application for conscientious objector status was rejected by the military. He's believed to be the first U.S. soldier to file for refugee status in Canada for refusing to fight in Iraq. His lawyer and the Solicitor General's office are expected to file written submissions by January 24th. After that, the judges said a decision would be made as soon as possible. If the board denies his request, he could be sent back to the United States to face a military tribunal. Hinsman is currently living in Toronto with his wife and son. He joins us on the phone from his Canadian home. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Ms. Skinman.
It's good to have you back on. We had you in the studio up at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation when we broadcast from Toronto. Can you tell us about the hearing last week?
Well, before the hearing even commenced, we had our hands tied a bit. As you stated, the Solicitor General of the Canadian government intervened in our case, and that's only done in about 5% of cases. And anyway, they raised the issue that they felt that the legality of the war in Iraq was irrelevant to our refugee claim. So we were unable to argue that in any way. And,
explain what that means.
Well, basically, they said whether the war is legal or whether it's illegal, it's irrelevant to what you're trying to do here, which... I mean, I would argue it's pretty ludicrous, because that was almost my entire rationale for coming here in the first place.
So what did you do?
We still argued our case. I mean, every day we see things happening in Iraq of an atrocious nature, and I think based upon how often they're occurring, it's clear that they aren't merely anomalies, but that they're systemic, and we tried to illustrate that through both submitted evidence and then also a former Marine staff sergeant who took part in the Iraqi war testified in my hearing.
That was Jimmy Massey?
Correct.
And Jimmy Massey, who was also on Democracy Now!, talked about the killing of unarmed civilians in Iraq?
Correct. He spelled that out in the case, and it was a very powerful. You could hear a pin drop in the room when he was given his account of what happened, and I think it made an impression on the Canada in general, but the hearing officer in particular, And it's one thing if we say, you know, all this stuff is happening in Iraq or if it's illegal, but if you actually see the face of what's happened over there, it's a lot more powerful.
For listeners and viewers who might not have caught you on Democracy Now!, you did serve in Afghanistan, is that right?
I did.
And can you talk about the decision that you made, why you decided you did not want to go to Iraq?
Well, I think it was, if you're ever going to go destroy a country or wreak havoc on a country, it would need to be justified. And every justification or rationale that we've ever offered for going to Iraq has been bogus. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There have been no links established between Saddam and international terrorists, and then the notion that we're going to bring democracy to Iraq we'll see if that comes to fruition, but I don't think we'll see it unless it's convenient to America's agenda there. So anyway, I felt that we had attacked Iraq without any defensive basis, and I think it's been well established at Nuremberg that you in those instances, you can't simply just say that you're following orders, but you have a duty and obligation to disobey.
Can you talk about the day you made your way up to Canada with your wife and child, what that meant for you? I mean, it was an enormous decision.
Well, it was definitely a big turning point in life, and I mean, when we made the decision, when we left, the decision had been made for a week, so we were pretty intent on what we were doing. But whether we succeed or fail, the consequences and repercussions will be lifelong in terms of either going to the States for jail or not being able to go to the States because we can remain in Canada.
So what happens now? Your hearing is held. When does the decision get made, and what does this mean for you? Can you stay in Canada?
Well, a decision will be handed down by the board member sometime after the written submissions are sent in, and I assume that would be February or March. And then in the event that he ruled in our favor, it would be done. We would fill out papers and be landed, but realistically, if he rules against us, first of all, we would appeal based on the grounds of we weren't allowed to argue the legality of the war, and we would go from there. And I think, based on a lot of case law that my lawyer has obtained, that the notion of saying that a soldier can't choose not to participate in a war that's illegal or wrong is ludicrous, because if you do, you're essentially knowingly do, you're a mercenary.
If you were to come back to this country, if Canada rules you cannot get political refugee status, you would be tried by a military tribunal?
A court-martial.
And what is your comment on that?
Well, you know, if I had did something wrong in the Army, if I had broke military equipment, if I had yelled at my commanding officer or anything, sure, that deserves punishment through the Uniform Code of Military Justice. A military can't function if you don't have firm discipline. But when you refuse to do something that's wrong, I don't see what good there is in being punished for it. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I would argue that the commander-in-chief of the military, what we're doing overseas is an act of hooliganism, and I'd be subjecting myself to a hooligan form of justice. My sentence there's no set sentence. It would be arbitrary. It would be based upon the decision of the command, and I don't think serving 5 years or one day for doing what I did is justified.
We had on the program with you when we were in Canada, Brandon Huey, who also was appealing for political refugee status. What is the latest with his case? Do you know, Jeremy Hinsman?
He had a hearing date sometime in November, and in October my hearing was postponed, and we share the same lawyer, and there was some sort of deal that my hearing would be first. So I assume his hearing will be shortly after the new year, but I don't know any concrete date.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Jeremy Hinsman, U.S. Army conscientious objector, currently in Canada, where he is seeking asylum. This is Democracy Now! As we continue to talk about soldiers, nearly 1,300 of them have died in Iraq since the invasion. Many thousands more have been wounded. Last week, the New England Journal of Medicine reported the U.S. is facing a, quote, severe shortage of surgeons in Iraq to treat wounded soldiers. It's now estimated more soldiers have been injured in Iraq than during the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, or the first years of the Vietnam conflict. And in what seems to be a chilling echo of Vietnam, UPI is finding that homeless shelters around the country are reporting that they're already seeing some recently returned Iraq veterans showing up in need of shelter. Mark Benjamin is UPI's investigations editor. He's been closely following the hidden U.S. casualties from the Iraq War. And he was awarded the American Legion's Top Journalism Prize for 2004 for his reporting on the plight of hundreds of sick, wounded, and injured soldiers in one particular base at Fort Stewart, Georgia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark Benjamin.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you talk about this piece that you wrote on the number of homeless veterans of the Iraq invasion?
Yes, homeless veterans from Iraq are just starting to show up at some homeless shelters around the country. I found 60. 50 of them have been in touch with the Veterans Administration, Department of Veterans Affairs. I found another 10 at a group of homeless shelters around Los Angeles called U.S. Vets. The thing that's most disturbing, I think, about the story is that most of the people that are professionals in this area, meaning advocates for homeless veterans, are very disturbed that these people are showing up already. The other very disturbing trend is that there is a correlation between mental problems and homelessness, and the number of troops coming home from this war with mental problems is quite shocking.
You talk about the mental problems like what?
Well, in general, it looks like what they call post-traumatic stress disorder. They used to call it shell shock in previous wars. The Army reported in the New England Journal of Medicine that 17% of all of the soldiers who are just stepping off the plane would screen positive for post-traumatic stress disorder, and this is a problem that often pops up weeks or months after serving in combat. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, as of last July, around 30,000 soldiers from Iraq had shown up at Departments of Veterans Affairs healthcare facilities, and one out of every five has been diagnosed with some sort of mental problem. So these are people that, of course, were screened as fit for service. So there's clearly something happening. And if you talk to the soldiers, what you'll find is that it is extremely, extremely tense and stressful combat. The enemy is, you know, 24/7, 360 degrees. I mean, it's really very intense kind of combat. There's often confusion between civilian and enemy combatant. It is just the kind of combat that the soldiers say causes, and the experts say causes serious mental problems.
And then what about the hidden casualties in addition to mental health problems? It's a story you have continued to cover that gets almost no coverage. We hear several thousand soldiers have been wounded, but your figures are much higher than that.
Well, the Pentagon is not counting in its casualties anyone who's not hit by the bullets or bombs of the enemy. And they are now, you know, releasing some of these figures. It's around, I believe, 15,000 just from Iraq soldiers have been medevaced out of Iraq for wounds or illnesses that occurred while in Iraq. But none of those soldiers appear on the Pentagon's casualty lists, even though they were, you know, often hurt and serving, you know, their trucks roll over, car accidents, that kind of thing. In fact, We're talking here about mental problems. About 17% of these soldiers who have possibly post-traumatic stress disorder. Even soldiers who are medevaced out of Iraq because they have had such serious mental problems, they had to be medevaced. None of those soldiers appear on Pentagon casualty lists.
There's a piece in the Boston Globe from last week by Raja Mishra, and it says U.S. troops injured in Iraq have required limb amputations at twice the rate of past wars, and as many as 20% have suffered head and neck injuries that will require a lifetime of care. The picture is the grisly flip side of improvements in battlefield medicine that have saved many combatants who would have died in the past. Only 1 in 10 U.S. troops injured in Iraq has died, the lowest rate of any war in U.S. history, but those who survive have much more grievous wounds.
Well, I think that's probably true. It is the flip side. I mean, in the Pentagon's defense, they do a really fabulous job, almost shocking how good they are at getting to these soldiers when they are severely injured, for example, by IEDs, these explosive devices in the field. If you talk to the soldiers, they'll say that if you make it to Landstuhl, which is the hospital that the military runs in Germany, if you make it there, you're going to live. And they get you out of Iraq very, very fast. I would just have to say that in contrast to that, my reporting seemed to indicate that there are other types of injuries that the military is not doing as such a good job treating. One of those would be mental problems, and I keep bringing that up because it's such a shocking pattern among soldiers that are returning, and I think many of those soldiers would say that they do not get the kind of care that they want and deserve.
Finally, another report out. This is from the Los Angeles Times that also came out last week about the shortage of surgeons to treat the wounded in Iraq. Army has fewer than 65 surgeons at any one time to cover 138,000 troops. And they're reporting on a piece from Atul Gawande, an assistant professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, who talks about those physicians that are there and the military wants to bring more and more back, are working under very difficult circumstances. In many cases, the military has taken over Iraqi hospitals and the facilities are flooded with civilian patients whom the Americans are unable to treat. With no clear directive from the Pentagon on treating civilians, some physicians refuse to help even pediatric patients out of fear the children could be booby-trapped with bombs.
I don't know whether these—I, of course, didn't report these stories, so I'm sure they're perfectly accurate. But one of the things I do think that they probably are is a reflection of a reality that is finally, I think, becoming very clear in the press, and that is just the size and the scope of this war. I mean, it may sound obvious to some people and not to others. I mean, I did a story last week on the number of troops. I got some Pentagon data on the number of troops that have been deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq since these two conflicts began, and it was just short of 1 million troops. 1 million troops had been deployed either to Operation Iraqi Freedom or Operation Enduring Freedom. 300,000 of those troops had been deployed more than once to one of those places. I mean, we are in a really, really big war. And what that means is anybody knows the military knows that there are only about 1.4 million active duty people wearing uniforms anywhere in the world. And about half of the number, I know I'm mixing up my numbers a little bit, but about 700,000 of those million I just referred to are active duty troops. What I'm getting at is that we have now gone through half the army. Half the military completely has now gone to war.
Well, Mark Benjamin, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, UPI Investigations Editor.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the apparent suicide of investigative reporter Gary Webb, author of Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the crack cocaine explosion. Stay with us. Jihan and Kamian, just you and I, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Gary Webb, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who wrote a series of stories linking the CIA to crack cocaine trafficking in Los Angeles, is dead. He died at the age of 49, found Friday morning at his home in Sacramento County, dead of an apparent suicide. Moving company workers called authorities after discovering a note posted on his front door that read, quote, "Please do not enter. Call 911 and ask for an ambulance." Webb died of a gunshot wound to the head, according to the Sacramento County Coroner's Office. He's survived by two sons and a daughter. Gary Webb's 1996 series in the San Jose Mercury News titled Dark Alliance revealed that for the better part of a decade, a Bay Area drug ring sold tons of cocaine to Los Angeles street gangs and funneled millions in drug profits to the CIA-backed Nicaraguan Contras. It provoked a fierce reaction from the media establishment, which denounced the series. Following the controversy, San Jose Mercury News executive editor demoted Webb within the paper. Gary Webb eventually resigned and pushed his investigation even further, publishing the book Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the Crack Cocaine Explosion. We're joined on the telephone now by Bob Perry. Veteran investigative journalist, wrote for AP and Newsweek. His reporting led to the exposure of what's now called the Iran-Contra scandal. His latest book is called Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Bob Perry, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
Well, I heard it from you this weekend that Gary Webb had died of an apparent suicide. Can you talk about Gary?
Well, I received a call on Saturday from the Los Angeles Times asking if I could comment about Webb's death, and I went on and explained that the country owes a huge debt to Gary Webb. What he did was revive a story that some of us at AP and then later Senator John Kerry looked into in the mid-1980s of how the Reagan-Bush administration had financed the Contra War, in part by allowing the Contras to engage in cocaine trafficking. The evidence, even in the mid-80s, was quite strong, and Kerry did a fairly good investigation that was published in a report in 1989. But throughout this, the Washington Press Corps, the New York Times, Washington Post, L.A. Times, denigrated these stories. Of course, the Reagan-Bush administration denied them, by and large, and that's where the story pretty much was left. Kerry had been ridiculed for being a conspiracy theorist, for following these leads, and it was Gary Webb who revived that investigation in 96 with his series on the San Jose Mercury News, and again, he was assaulted by these same news elements, the New York Times, Washington Post, L.A. Times, but what he did was he provoked an investigation, an internal investigation at Justice and at the CIA. And those investigations, while the press releases tended to be protective of the agencies, the information contained in the long reports was devastating. Essentially, the CIA admitted that it was involved with the Contras who were actively participating in cocaine trafficking. The CIA Inspector General said that more than 50 Contras and Contra units were implicated in the cocaine trade, that the CIA knew about it real time, that it hid the evidence, that it obstructed justice. All these things were admitted by the CIA itself by 1998 in response to Webb's series. The great tragedy, I suppose, of the personal tragedy and the professional tragedy is that despite these admissions, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the L.A. Times still refused to deal with the facts. It seemed almost like the editors had more of a stake in covering up the truth than the CIA did. And so Gary Webb's career was allowed to be ruined. The people who were involved in these in protecting the CIA from those major papers, their careers blossomed. Jerry Sipos, the executive editor of the San Jose Mercury News, who essentially sold out Webb and his series, received an award from the Society for Professional Journalists for ethics because of what he did. So it seemed like all the people that did the wrong thing got the benefits. And Gary Webb and people, including John Kerry, who did honorable work on this topic, received no benefits at all and, in fact, were damaged.
Robert Perry, I wanted to play a clip of an interview that we did with Gary Webb on May 20th, 1998. It was just after his book, Dark Alliance, was published, and he talked about the media reaction to his investigation in the San Jose Mercury News. This is Gary Webb, 1998.
I tried to think of another example of where the mainstream press took off after a reporter, and the only one I was able to think of was when that fellow wrote that sort of confessional about how he'd worked at the Wall Street Journal and had been a socialist all these years, and the hue and cry that went up over, my God, we actually let a socialist write our news for us. That's really the only other time it's been, you know, this quite this intense.
Well, we now have your book, Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the crack cocaine explosion. Do you expect a similar explosion from the press, or will they try to deal with it by ignoring it?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think it'll be interesting. You know, they couldn't ignore it before because it was in the newspapers. Now it's in a different arena. Now, I mean, books routinely get ignored that sort of challenge the status quo and challenge the common knowledge. It might be more difficult this time because they had set up such a screaming contest earlier. You know, this isn't the series anymore. I mean, this is, 600 pages of, of documentation, of interviews. It's going to be awful hard to dismiss this as, unsubstantiated or, not backed up or overhyped, which were the criticisms that were directed against the series. Because the information's there now. It's all laid out, and it's, I didn't have to worry about some editor chopping off 15 paragraphs to make sure, the bra ad could fit on the page. I had the room to tell the story like it should have been told in the first place. And I think, looking back on this whole thing, I think the problem that we had in doing this series was that we were overly ambitious. I mean, we tried to tell a story in, 10,000, 12,000 words, that really needed about 150,000 words to tell accurately and tell completely. And it sort of, I don't regret doing it, and I'm glad we did. Otherwise, this thing would never have gotten out. But in doing the book, I realized how sort of crippled we were just by the medium that we were trying to do it in. So I think it'll be interesting to see what the mainstream's reaction to the book is, if there is one.
Gary, the way the mainstream press dealt with the black community responding in the way they did, I found remarkably condescending.
That was offensive.
It was basically the attitude was, we understand why these people are so upset. Something terrible has happened to them, and it's finally nice to be able to blame it on someone or something.
Right.
So we understand this kind of over-response or this willingness to believe in conspiracy.
I mean, I don't think there's any other word for it, but it was racist. I've never seen an entire race labeled as conspiracy theorists before, and this was really that's when I thought they'd really gone off the deep end when they were trying to convince everybody that, well, these black people, they believe anything they're told, which was, when you boil it down, that's exactly what these articles were saying, and they tried to couch it in these very scientific and sociological terms as to why blacks distrust government, but the bottom line was, these folks will believe anything. And Tom Tomorrow did, I thought, just an amazingly good cartoon about this whole thing. When he had two New York Times reporters sitting around talking, and one of them said, "Well, just because the United States government has a history of lying to the American public, and just because there's 10 years of documented evidence of CIA involvement in drug trafficking, they actually think this might be true." And the other guy goes, "Those Negroes will believe anything." And that was sort of the reaction in a very cut down form of what these long wheezes in the Post, the New York Times did one, I think the LA Times did one, Washington Post did one on, why, of course black people are upset because they all believe that, Kentucky Fried Chicken will make you sterile, and as if they have no reason whatsoever to believe that the United States government doesn't have their best interest at heart at times. I mean, look at the Tuskegee experiment, and you could go on through history to explain why people of color would not trust the government. But the other thing that these stories missed was that you know, it wasn't just black people that were upset by this thing. I mean, I was on a lot of right-wing talk radio shows, and the people that called into those shows were as mad or madder than the black audiences that I addressed, because I mean, these were people who, I think, like me, believed what they were taught in school about the government. You know, the government always has your best interest at heart. The government would never do anything to harm its citizens. Drugs are evil. We would never be involved in it. And when they read the story and when they saw the documentation that we presented, they knew that they had been lied to. They knew they had been lied to for about 10 years on this whole drug war thing. And they were really offended. It wasn't that they grew up distrusting the government. It was just the opposite. They grew up believing in it. And here was yet another example of why their faith had been misplaced, because, you know, American citizens had been sacrificed to fight this crazy war down in Central America that really didn't mean anything to anybody but the people at the CIA.
Gary Webb in 1998, May 20th, an interview we did when his book, Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the Crack Cocaine Explosion, first came out. This is Democracy Now! We'll get a final comment from investigative reporter Bob Perry. As you listen to Gary Webb, your thoughts, Bob?
Well, I think it's quite sad that that voice has been silenced. It was tragic and sad that the mainstream press reacted as it did. As I said to the LA Times on Saturday when they asked for my comments, which they did not publish, by the way, I said, you're going to have a hard time dealing with this story because the LA Times never even reported on the publication of the second volume of the CIA's report. And it was that second volume that went through in great detail, really corroborating not just what Gary Webb had reported, but allegations and evidence that's far, far worse than what was in the San Jose Mercury News series. This was a far darker scandal, went far higher up than anyone thought. The CIA's evidence even tracks the Contra cocaine problem into the White House, Ronald Reagan's White House. It tracks it into the CIA directly. That's what the evidence is. I'm putting up a story today on consortiumnews.com that will recount some of this evidence that has been lost to history. And it's just tragic that the LA Times and other major publications cannot now face the truth.
Well, Bob Perry, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us. People can check that story out at consortiumnews.com. And you can go to our website at democracynow.org, where we will compile all of Gary Webb's interviews. Gary Webb, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, died of an apparent suicide. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Again, our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.